On July 7, 1993, Judge Daniel Friedman, writing for the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, filed the decision of the circuit on Leonard Peltier's third appeal. It is of no great shock to those of us familiar with the case that the three judges panel chose to ignore both facts and past circuit findings in reaffirming Leonard Peltier's conviction. Lost in the political mire were the words of Senior Circuit Judge Gerald Heaney, affidavits proving gross FBI misconduct on the reservation, and the very real and total admission of Prosecutor Lynn Crooks that the government does not know who killed the FBI agents. The court claims that the government's theory on the case against Leonard Peltier did not change, and that the prosecutors argued it as both first-degree murder and aiding and abetting, both at close range or at a distance of over 2 football fields away. One would think, in agreement with the words of Judge Heaney during Leonard's second appeal, that the case against Leonard Peltier would be an entirely different case, both in terms of manner in which it was presented and the sentence the judge imposed, if the only complete... The only evidence was that Leonard Peltier was participating on the periphery. They have completely ignored 2 separate findings by the same circuit that state that Leonard Peltier's trial was for close-up first-degree murder, period. As the circuit wrote in its 1986 decision, we could have resolved this issue without much difficulty if the government had presented the case on the theory that he was an aider and abettor. But this is not the government's theory. This time, blatantly going against the findings of the judges who make up their own circuit, the court ignored both facts and past circuit findings in reaffirming Leonard Peltier's conviction. Lost in the political mire were the words of Senior Circuit Judge Gerald Heaney, affidavits proving gross FBI misconduct on the reservation, and the very real and total admission of Prosecutor Lynn Crooks that the government does not know who killed the FBI agents. The court claims that the government's theory on the case against Leonard Peltier did not change, and that the prosecutors argued it as both first-degree murder and aiding and abetting, both at close range or at a distance of over 2 football fields away. One would think, in agreement with the words of Judge Heaney during Leonard's second appeal, that the case against Leonard Peltier would be an entirely different case, both in terms of manner in which it was presented and the sentence the judge imposed, if the only complete... The only evidence was that Leonard Peltier was participating on the periphery. They have completely ignored 2 separate findings by the same circuit that state that Leonard Peltier's trial was for close-up first-degree murder, period. As the circuit wrote in its 1986 decision, we could have resolved this issue without much difficulty if the government had presented the case on the theory that he was an aider and abettor. But this is not the government's theory. This time, blatantly going against the findings of the judges who make up their own circuit, the court has concluded that this statement cannot overcome that the government was asserting that Peltier either personally committed the murders or aided and abetted their commission. We have read the statement 1,000 times and invite you to do the same. Could it have been written any clearer? They do admit that evidence was circumstantial at best. However, they used the disturbing lack of evidence to somehow validate the concession made by Prosecutor Lynn Crooks. We can't prove who shot those agents. During the November 9th oral arguments against themselves, Judge Friedman asked Prosecutor Lynn Crooks to better explain the statement. Mr. Crooks went on for quite some time, stating that there was no direct evidence, no eyewitnesses, and nothing substantial to tie Leonard Peltier to the actual deaths of those agents. Judge Friedman responded with, "That to me seems quite significant." He went on, however, to drag Crooks from the damaging waters into which he had fallen by answering his own question, which he reiterates in the court's decision. The government did not present any direct evidence, since all of the government's proof was circumstantial. It goes on to challenge the defense's assertions by calling this important admission an 8-word comment, completely disregarding the fact that Mr. Crooks spent nearly a quarter of his time during argument attempting to explain it all away. By misusing the McCluskey standard, which states that for cases in which constitutional violations have caused the conviction of one innocent of the crime, judicial intervention is called for. The court dismissed each claim set forth by the defense as claims that were either litigated previously or could or should have been litigated. This catch-22 is clearly not applicable to the Peltier case because anyone with even the most rudimentary understanding of the circumstances surrounding the investigation, trial, and subsequent appeals can see that evidence of innocence exists and evidence of guilt has gone from substantial to circumstantial to apparently fabricated. Yet the court has ruled that because these claims should have been argued before, they cannot be made now. There is absolutely no reference as to whether or not these claims are valid, only that they have been made in an untimely fashion. This includes the Duane Brewer affidavit that clearly describes the full involvement of the FBI in illegally training, arming, and encouraging the activities of the local Indian police known as the Goon Squad during the terrible reign of terror on the Pine Ridge Reservation. This information was a distinct example of misconduct on the part of the FBI. The court writes that Pelcher gives no explanation for his failure to obtain that evidence earlier. Are we then to assume that the court expected Leonard Pelche to somehow magically get a former goon leader like Brewer to freely give such information at his own simple request? If and when more documentation is available through a new Freedom of Information Act suit, would it be dismissed because we should have gone into the archives and had it stolen? In short, this argument is absurd in its entirety. We feel that this latest so-called judicial remedy is unacceptable. To purposely act as another prosecutor against a defendant and or to meet with FBI agents or other prejudicial law enforcement is neither ethical nor legal, and that is what happened here. Leonard Pelche remains in prison despite a lack of direct evidence. The withholding of exculpatory evidence, witness coercion, and a concession by the government that they did not and have not proven what part he may have played in the June 26, 1975 firefight. He has spent over 17 years fighting for his freedom, and despite the setback, the fight will continue. This is only the beginning. From here on in, there will be no stone unturned, no polite silence, only the rage against a blatant injustice that will not cease until remedied. We are asking our supporters to write to the President, Attorney General, and the judges on the Eighth Circuit to express their anger on this continued injustice and to demand a full and independent investigation into the FBI and judicial procedures responsible for Leonard's illegal incarceration, including allegations that Judges Morris Arnold, Daniel Friedman, and Theodore McMillan held secret meetings with FBI agents while considering this most recent appeal.
So those of you who want more information, would like a copy of this press release, can contact us here at Smoke Signals by calling and leaving a message at 661-2111, extension 5083. Or you can contact us, myself at home, at 659-4682. Another matter that has come up that has really started to gain awareness, consciousness raising, sensitization, is this group by the name of the Coalition Against First Nations Genocide. This coalition was started by the Obanswan Irwin Group, who has been largely responsible for the raising awareness of what the federal government of Canada is right now doing, in that it's quietly extinguishing our treaty and Aboriginal rights. For some time now, the Canadian government has been determined to take away treaty and Aboriginal rights from our people. This all started a few years ago when a top secret government study revealed that if the Canadian government paid up to First Nations what was owing under treaties and recognized Aboriginal rights under the Royal Proclamation of 1763 and the British North America Act, it would cost an enormous amount of money. The government decided rather than to pay up, it would instead extinguish our powers. Now, this began about 1985 when a fellow by the name of Eric Nielsen from the Yukon was conducting this top secret government study, and he found and uncovered all this information about how much it would cost the Canadian government. So rather, as is stated, rather than pay, they would rather extinguish our powers. This is what the government has decided. This is where the bureaucracy is moving. But the federal conservative government is the one that's really starting to spearhead this movement. And the tools which will extinguish the First Nations powers and our rights are being implemented this year. The first one being taxation. There's a secret government paper that's titled Working Paper on Indian Government Taxation. And it says that the taxation of Aboriginal people will be taken away in two steps. One, the first step is off-reserve taxation, which is already going to be happening. The taxation rights are to be taken away next January the 1st, 1994. As I said, the government's already announced this. And not only will this take away all taxation rights for those working off-reserve, but it'll seriously affect First Nations businesses and those of you who, as part of your job, spend time off-reserve. All off-reserve time is to be taxed as of next year. And B, the taxation that's going to be taking place on the reserve, the Canadian government is in the process of passing legislation which will clear the way for taxation to start being applied on reserve. And the extinguishment of our land. The Canadian government has developed a piece of legislation called the First Nations Chartered Land Act. Now, we here at Smoke Signals have been raising awareness and talking about this piece of legislation called the First Nations Chartered Land Act for some time. But this legislation is on its way to Parliament, and it will be passed unless stopped within a few months. Now, hopefully, it will not be passed in September when Parliament reconvenes. There will be a new government, so it will probably be sitting before the House after the election. Another movement is that First Nations are to become municipalities. The Canadian government is, through self-government agreements and the transfer of programs and services to First Nations, they will be accomplishing several objectives. The first one being that by turning over one lump sum of money to a First Nations to run all of its programs and services, the Canadian government will be better able to control expenditures. If a First Nations asks for extra money to do something, it will be told to take the money from other programs and services controlled by the First Nations. Now, that's obvious why they would want to do that. And the municipal structure that is being worked out is the First Nations Governance Recognition Act, which is developed by the Canadian government. This will put the First Nations under provincial jurisdiction with some federal control. The Community Government Acts will apply to communities to remove them from the Indian Act and turn them into municipalities. And once a First Nation signs a claim settlement, it has to, quote, cede, release, and surrender to Her Majesty the Queen in right of Canada all their Aboriginal claims, rights, titles, and interests, if any, unquote. At the same time, those who sign are transferred to provincial control. So we believe that the OI group believe that the Canadian government is conducting genocide of our people, and most of us don't even know it. Right now, Mary Lou will read to us a letter that was written by a good friend of ours, Alex Jameson, on the Six Nations Reserve. His Indian name is Gawitra, and he wrote this letter to the editor of Tekawanagay. Tekawanagay is a publication out of Six Nations. It's their newspaper there, and this is what Gawitra has to say about the original and treaty rights here on Smoke Signals.
Back at the turn of the century, British North America was sitting pretty. It was part of the huge British Commonwealth and had no external threats to worry about. Internally as well, there were few concerns. Some sour grapes in Quebec and huge fiduciary obligations to an Aboriginal population which was swiftly dying off from disease, neglect, and starvation. Quebec proved to be manageable, and of course, all treaty obligation would disappear along with the disappearing red man. Soon, they must have thought, the whole of Canada with all its rich resources would be theirs free and clear. But something went terribly wrong. The red man survived to become a thorn in Canada's flesh, the millstone around its neck, and a source of great international embarrassment. Like wealthy young heirs to a fabulous fortune, who has been ill-treated and cast off by its own guardian, the native people have now come of age and have returned to claim their inheritance, only to find that Canada has spent it all on high living. In a mystery thriller, such a scenario would have the evil guardian attempting to protect his image and interests by plotting ways to get rid of the young heirs once and for all. This is exactly Canada's grand plan. Through the implementation of its Buffalo Jump policies, devolution, the transfer of programs like police, CAS, education, etc., self-government comprehensive claim settlements, alternative legislation, and the Aboriginal constitutional package, Canada will finally succeed in destroying the Native Nations and getting out from all the treaty obligations. This is all spelled out in Walter Rudnicki's October 1992 analysis of the Charlottetown Accord of last August. Every Native adult should become familiar with this material. It is called the Aboriginal Constitutional Package of 1992, its hidden sting. This paper describes why the Indian Act is basically illegal, Canada's grand plan for our termination, why Canada prefers to deal with groups it has created, band councils and Native organizations like the AFN, rather than the Native Nations, why Native Nations are still recognized as nations, how we can protect our nationhood, why we still have title to the land, why our sovereignty is still intact, why Canada's rule of law did not apply to Mohawks at Oka, the emptiness of such terms as inherent rights and self-government, why we have a valid claim to huge reparation payments, how some of our own people are helping the government, why all provinces were happy with the Charlottetown Accord, how Bob Rae played the part of the good cop, why any natives who push for those government initiatives are either ignorant, insane, or just plain sellouts. Thanks to Walter Rudnicki, a former senior analyst with the Department of Indian Affairs, our worst suspicions about the government have been confirmed. Through his attempt to warn us, as he has likely sealed his own fate. But now there is no need to speculate further. We now know beyond doubt that the government and any of our own people who are pushing government policy are working against our best interests as Native nations. Band councils and Native organizations can be seen now for what they are. These government-sponsored organizations should be rejected and despised by all Native people who value their nationhood, their culture, their inheritance, and the future of their children. Using the good mind, we can hopefully assume that the person who advocated this position did so out of sincere concern, but also out of ignorance. And now the expositor is coming up with a series on cigarette smuggling. It is an act which almost certainly create more anti-Native feelings. It almost seems as if it's been timed to coincide with the government's push to eliminate the Native people through eliminating our status. Good journalism is supposed to be balanced. It will be interesting to see if this series includes the reporting of non-Native smuggling activities as well. On this issue, it must be said that had the government treated us properly and continued to recognize our nationhood, there would be no need for us to resort to these activities. The Six Nations people would have no need for government money or cigarette money if the government would pay us half of what it owes us. Personally, I have greater respect for cigarette dealers who try to maintain their nationhood than I have for those of our people who collaborate with the government for a paycheck. And it's signed Gawitra.
Yahweh, Mary Lou. Yes, that's that is going to also be the premise of our feature tape this afternoon. We're going to right now take a music break with Morning Prayer from Sharon Birch with Paul Ortega from their album entitled The Blessing Ways, here on Smoke Signals.